most of the enmity or disregard for cycling that I see doesn't come from the fact that we're scofflaws. It comes from the fact that we're in their way. It's their road. They don't want to have to deal with the other. These individuals also get in road rages with other motor vehicles, but they can't quite be as the big a bully when it's another vehicle or a motor vehicle. So they take out a lot of their transgressions on us. When you get to chapter 5, you'll see that I've written a bit about these issues, conflict on the road.
Well, that's Bob Mayansky. He's an author. His book, Bicycling and the Law, Your Rights as a Cyclist. And he's a fascinating character, a charming man, an Olympic cyclist and attorney. And I pull his leg a few times during our interview together that his book, I enjoyed it much more than I thought. So if you were susceptible to prejudice like I was, how can an attorney write an interesting book about cycling and the law? Well, stop right there. You're going to enjoy getting to know Bob Mayansky on tonight's show. And I'm Frank Peters, and I'm your host. This is CDM Cyclist. It's a blog about cycling safety. The CDM, as in Corona del Mar, my little neighborhood, Appalachian within Newport Beach, California. Beautiful community where we're just beginning to take steps to make it safer for cyclists on the road. That's a very exciting process. And if you come to the website, you'll see many references to the Newport Beach Bike Safety Committee. We meet once a month. And anyway, a lot going on here in Southern California. Well, Bob, I just got back from a weekend in Portland. So you'd think that I sat down with Bob while I was in Portland, but no, his travel schedule and mine didn't line up, so we did the interview via Skype. But I'll be back to Portland. I have family now in Portland, and for a budding bicycle advocate, there isn't a better place to be. I'll spend more time with Bob in the months ahead, I'm hoping. Well, before we get any further, let me say thank you to my sponsor. That's BikeTiresDirect.com. Bike tires, yes, and apparel, gear. I bought another light for my bicycle. I keep talking about lights. I keep experimenting. You know, there's myself, my son, my wife. I'm enjoying going out at night. Some of the activities, Boy Scouts and tutoring. And well, I've found a few opportunities to pedal around at night. And you know what I find? It's quieter, less traffic. Some of the back roads here along the beach. The other night I went out and, oh, what do you know, one of my headlights goes out. Well, no sweat. I'm a former Boy Scout myself. I've got two headlights. But then the other one starts to dim, and I worry about getting home safely. So I'm upgrading my lights. Where else would I go to do that? BikeTiresDirect.com. Check them out, please. Well, let's get right to it with Bob. He covers a lot of material. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Bob Mayansky, author of Bicycling and the Law.
Well, Bob, I've enjoyed Bicycling and the Law much more than I thought I would. So, do other people say that too?
I get a mixed response after people read the book. Some take me to task over some section that they don't agree with. But
yeah, sure.
It's natural. Right.
Yeah, other attorneys, I'm guessing.
You know, surprisingly, the attorneys seem to be okay with it. Maybe they don't make it through, but the attorneys seem to like it as a reference guide.
What were your motivations when you sat down to write the book? Because it's quite an undertaking, almost 400 pages. So that took some dedication. What motivated that, Bob?
Well, I had been writing a column, a legal column, for a website and a magazine for about 10 years, and someone mentioned that I should consider writing a book. And they also had a connection with a publishing house. So we started the conversation. And at first I had an idea of what the book would be like. But in the end, it was took a little different direction. It was a bit more of a reference guide and historical account of cycling in America and our rights and responsibilities.
Let's bite into one. One of your early sections was, can you legally run a red light?
Okay, so can you be more specific?
Well,
that wasn't a question.
I know it. Yeah, I'm dealing with an attorney, I can tell. So, how did that get to be a section? I mean, apparently you can legally run a red light. What are the conditions when, let's say, you won't get a ticket for running a red light on a bike?
Well, it's interesting you brought this one up because I was just contacted by a senator here in the state of Oregon about whether or not Oregon has that provision. And we're discussing the situation where you're at a red light and your vehicle, which happens to be a bicycle, fails to trigger the loop sensor. In other words, the light's not going to ever turn green while you're standing there.
Sure.
And so a number of states have a written exception, which is a sensible thing. After a while, you can, you know, proceed through the intersection without the green, and you treat it like a stop sign because the device is broken, and otherwise, where would you be? You'd be stuck at that intersection maybe forever or until another vehicle comes. And if it's in the middle of the night, that may not happen for a long time. But getting back to the Oregon example, we have no exception for that, so it wouldn't be legal in Oregon to do so.
Wow, that sounds like oversight. You think of Oregon, great leadership in this area, but not in all cases, apparently, huh?
Well, hopefully after tomorrow, it'll get the ball starting in motion. And I think that was the nature of the inquiry. And it's a commonsensical provision. You know, intersections, sure, they're there to direct the traffic. And picture yourself at 4 a.m. or some other time or in a rarely used road, and you're sitting at a light and it won't change. And you may have seen cyclists will get off their bike and walk over and hit the walk sign if one exists to trigger the loop sensor.
Right. But traffic could make that precarious too. When I read about this in your book, I immediately knew what intersection this happens to me at. I just started writing again. Can I still call it midlife? So I was relearning a lot of things. And anyway, there's this intersection I go through every day on my ride, and I had trouble triggering the light. So I learned to just kind of work my way through it. So I guess you'd say I got a little cavalier with that. And then I had my 15-year-old son with me one day, and there I am moving through this red light on my own, and I realized I hadn't coordinated it with him. So he hesitated, and just that split second when he moved through the intersection, he put himself in much more of a dangerous situation than I did. So that kind of gave me a chill. I'm not going to forget that for a while. So if you've got a buddy, I suppose the corollary is you talk through it all, huh?
Yeah, I think if you're riding with somebody, you have a relationship with them, if you've ridden with them before. And sometimes it's based on the kind of rider they are. The interesting scenario is when you come upon another cyclist that you have no connection with, but you happen to be traveling in the same direction. And then, of course, that's also an opportunity for bike-on-bike conflict. In fact, I have an email I'm responding to at length about an individual that had a bad encounter that started out much like the one we're describing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you get emails, Bob, from people who have read the book?
I do, and others that are familiar with my column at Bicycling Magazine or my webpage or my blog. And I get a very healthy share of emails on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I scroll through, and if it looks like it's going to take 20 minutes to read it, I put it off till later.
Yeah, right. So I'll have links on the blog. You come to cdmcyclist.com, and I'll have links to Bob's column and his book as well. And then, Bob, you're running a practice in Portland. You've got lots of people riding bikes in Portland. That keeps you busy.
It does. We have a number of bicycle attorneys and some prominent ones, in fact, here in Portland. So I don't get all the cases. And the sort of meat and potato law firms have recognized that bicycling is a legitimate form of transportation and that people get injured. And so they've started to market for these cases as well. So it's slim pickings. But my orientation, I really I'm interested in bike advocacy first and foremost, and cycling rights, and then try to make a living secondarily. And sometimes I might get those priorities backwards, but that's how I prefer to approach it. And I'm lucky to live here. I didn't move here because of the cycling. I've been coming to Oregon for 25 years, and I love the state. I got a chance to move here, and my daughter was born here, and we're staying, at least I'm staying.
Well, I reached out to you, Bob, because my sister just moved to, she and her family just moved to Portland from Palo Alto. And of course, I've visited many times. I still have friends from my days at U of O. But when I visited just a few months ago, oh boy, I really enjoyed it. So I'm bringing my wife and son up to spend a weekend real soon.
Well, that'll be good. Maybe we'll run into you on the roads, right? Will you be cycling?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I was last time I was up. Of course, it's quite a bit cooler for me. You know, it's I know you get used to it, but it's quite a, what would you call that? A psychological issue for me. This weekend it was 78 degrees in here in Newport Beach, which will get you spoiled, huh?
Yeah, indeed. Well, we have had some great days recently, and I was talking to another cyclist, and he was calling it Junuary.
Really? Yeah.
And because it hit 52.
Wow.
So.
Well, getting back to, there are a couple of things I want to cover, but this concept of a uniform vehicle code, that was a little bit of a surprise to me, that there is kind of like a standard body of law that many states have adopted. Are there other examples of such uniformity in law, or is it just with vehicle codes, Bob?
No, there are other examples. The evidence code, when you're in a court of law, and you're making the determination about what the fact finder will be able to hear, it gets very complicated. And there's a standard body of law that most states have adopted completely with a few alterations. And there are other examples. The UVC is good, but it doesn't address a lot of cycling issues. And it would be nice to see more uniformity of cycling laws nationally.
Well, speaking of cycling laws, I did cycling merit badge with the Boy Scouts last spring, and oh, did I have a great time. I didn't realize how much fun that was going to be. I had maybe 10 scouts and many of the moms and dads along too. And one thing that, what would be that age, 12, 13, they can't go anywhere without their earbuds on. And so I was waving my finger at them, and the kids were seemed to know their stuff. They were barking right back at me. What is the uniform rule of thumb when it comes to, let's say, cell phones and earbuds, Bob?
Well, absolutely. There is no uniformity. It's going to vary. Yep, it's going to vary by the laws of each state, and they run the gamut from no restriction to California, where you have to have one ear free. And just this last week, we've had a lawmaker here in the state of Oregon propose a prohibition for using earphones, but it ran counter to another recent law, which required earphones and headphones for motorists, hands-free.
Oh, right.
So that's the problem, is that there is no uniformity. In fact, it's just the opposite.
You know what I've done is I've taken my white earbuds, like I see you using, and I've cut one ear off. Well, the earbud off, so that if I ever get pulled over, I'll have evidence at hand there.
Yeah, that's not bad. These are quite expensive. I don't think I'm going to do that, but we don't have that rule in Oregon.
Oh, is that right? You can wear them?
You can, and it's interesting because it opened up a public debate last week when this bill was floated. There were two bills. One was to prohibit children from under the age of 6 from being carried on a bike.
Didn't that start a firestorm? Even I heard about that down here in Los Angeles. Wow.
Really? I didn't know it had spread outside the state. It did. And that bill and this one was from another lawmaker, the one referring to headphone use or earphone use. And they've both been withdrawn because of the negative reaction. But it did open up quite a debate. And during that debate, I was able to learn a bit about what people's feelings are on the matter, and there are many that will argue that a pair of earphones turned down to a low volume allow them to hear traffic coming because it kills the wind, and they can also answer their phone if they have a Bluetooth, and they didn't feel like it was a safety hazard. Most of the people that were against it were motorists, that didn't ride. So I found that interesting.
Well, that brings up another subject. How about you personally? It's brought up, of course, as a safety measure. How about you personally? Are you riding with earbuds on?
I do most of the time. It's something I started doing 25 years ago when I didn't even see another cyclist on the road, let alone one wearing earphones or headphones.
How about your daughter, though? You've got a daughter. Is she of cycling age yet? Would you let her?
No, I wouldn't let her ride in the traffic alone. Anyhow, we live kind of in the urban area of Portland. A lot of bike paths, but a lot of intersections. And she's not that. She splits her time between here and her mother's home, and they live in the country, so she does her riding over there. When she rides in the city, we ride together, and neither of us wears any kind of earphone. Mm-hmm. I don't wear them in the city. I wear them when I finally get out in the country, and I use a mirror.
Okay. All right, and you use a mirror.
I do, and that really separates me for some reason. Have you used a mirror, Frank?
No, and some of my friends, I can picture them right now, wagging their finger at me to get a mirror, and that would be particularly good for me.
Well, what I would recommend is that you just try it without any pressure, just to see what it's all about. And my prediction is you'll love it.
I'll never take it off the bike, right?
I won't. I have them on every cruiser bike. And it's interesting because it's a challenge so that you're able to see behind you while you're riding in your natural state. So you have to put the mirrors in different places. I have on my racing bike one that comes out of the bar end where normally you put a plug there to keep the tape from unraveling.
Right.
And I don't even think people see it. I use it in races even, and I guess it's quite the talk of the town. On my other bikes, I have one on the down tube, and I have one on the fork. The only problem is you do become dependent on them, and that's how valuable they are to me. And so if I end up on a bike without it, and I come to a situation where I want to know what's going on behind me, instead of turning my head, I'm looking at my fork or somewhere else for a reflective glass.
Right, right, a habit, yeah. All right, so there's a takeaway for me. In this interview today, I'm going to get, I use earbuds only when there's great bike paths here that go the length of through several cities along the beach. And so there are no cars and, the worst thing that's going to happen is somebody on another bicycle overtakes you. So it's, especially off season, really safe. So I'll use an earbud in those situations. But,
Frank, that's an interesting point. If you wouldn't mind going back to it for a second.
Yeah.
The mirror, I don't know exactly how a mirror is going to help you with a car. You'll hear a car coming, and then what will you... I'm sorry, we're speaking about earphones. And what will you do? Will you, change your route of your direction of travel? Will you get off the road? But, so in other words, the value with automobiles for me is on smaller, narrow roads, if I see a car, an oncoming car, I will glance in my mirror to see if all three of us are going to pass at the same time. And then I can make a series of decisions based on the exigencies or, the way that the vehicles are all coming together. On a bike path or on a multiple use path, a MUP, earphones, I'm going back and forth between mirrors and earphones, but the earphones on a multiple use path are probably more hazardous in my view because of the bike on bike problem, the pedestrian issue. And it's a constant situation where a slower cyclist will be overtaken or a faster one will overtake you. On the roads, I don't seem to have those encounters as much. It's just me and the cars.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, because the bike paths are. The first thing I did when I got my bike was put a bell on it because navigating the bike paths around here in any time other than the winter are quite crowded. And you can only say on your left, when you're on top of them. Right, so... Anyway, the bell is important. Yeah, I see your point. Yeah, I would use the mirror when I was about to overtake a pedestrian or another cyclist, and that would be a good time to have the mirror.
I agree.
Okay, let's switch gears, talk about the Idaho stop. Some of my buddies told me about this. Every time I go for a ride with one of my pals, he wants to... have this implemented in California, the Idaho stop. What does that mean, Bob?
Well, I think the quickest way to define it would be to use its other description, which is a stop as yield. Mm-hmm. And so what you're doing is you're treating stop signs as yield signs, meaning you have a responsibility when you come to such an intersection to not violate anybody else's right of way. You need to see that the roads are clear before you proceed. this is kind of how people ride their bikes anyhow. So it's essentially getting the law to conform to habit. I've got a lot of thoughts on it. It's not a particularly dangerous thing when it's treated rationally.
You're choosing your words closely there.
Well,
I can tell, because this is one of the things that incites motorists. We both hear from them, right?
Yeah, but if you're doing it the right way, it shouldn't. Because, for instance, if you come to a road where, let's say you're in Idaho, and they have this law for 25 years, and you come to a stop sign, and there's a vehicle already in the intersection, you have to stop. If there's another vehicle about to enter the intersection, you have to stop. In other words, you have to wait until it's clear. And then at that point, you can proceed. So maybe you're rolling at 1 or 2 miles an hour by that point, which is pretty much what cyclists do anyhow. You can stay clipped in, which is safer. A lot of collisions occur when a cyclist is trying to get started again, trying to get their momentum, trying to get clipped in. And they take their eye off the flow and they get hit in that scenario. They've been better off staying in their clips. Frank, another issue is in the state of Oregon, I saw something the other day. It was a study done by someone just on their own, and they went and watched intersections to see how different vehicle users treated the stop sign. And they determined that only 22% of motorists stop at stop signs, make a complete stop, and 7% of cyclists do. So they're three times better than we are, but they're 20 times more dangerous than us.
Right, and they make so much noise. That's one thing. As I've started the blog, I call it the SMS crowd. Stop means stop. I often think it's a demographic, too, a certain age group. I see that with some of my friends. They'll turn purple when you start talking about bicycling advocacy, because it bothers them so much, behaviors they see, and they often will describe them as stop means stop.
Well, the thing about that, part of the energy behind that kind of mentality is that if cyclists adhere completely to every single rule, that will start getting more respect and acceptability, which makes sense, but I don't think it's actually true. In other words, most of the enmity or disregard for cycling that I see doesn't come from the fact that we're scofflaws. It comes from the fact that we're in their way. It's their road. They don't want to have to deal with the other. These individuals also get in road rages with other motor vehicles, but they can't quite be as the big a bully when it's another vehicle or motor vehicle. Mm. So they take out a lot of their transgressions on us. When you get to chapter 5, you'll see that I've written a bit about these issues, conflict on the road.
Yeah. Well, in Newport Beach, we just installed Sharrows on one little stretch of road. It's probably 1 mile in length, right along the water. It's called Bayside, pretty tame. Speed limits drop as low as 15 miles an hour, so we put Sharrows in there. It's well suited for that. It's very narrow. And I have had some amazing encounters there since the city put in Sharrows. I get the feeling that there are some people quite resentful, some motorists quite resentful, that we're in their way. And they'll cross a double yellow line and not hesitate to say something as they pass you by, putting themselves and us at great risk. But anyway, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and then they'll yell that you're unsafe while they're doing it.
Right.
Well, we're all, the more people that ride bikes, the better it's going to be for all of us. And we also have to, wait for the baby boomers to stop driving. I'm one of them. I made the tail end of that, 62. But it's difficult to accept a new paradigm. It's much easier to grow up in a new system. And like you have your children riding or your son, and I have mine and most of my friends do. And that's quite different than when I was growing up in the early 70s. We no one rode with their parents. At least I never saw it one time in my entire childhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, my 15-year-old son, I was after him a little while ago to start riding his bike to school. He did it last year, and school is 3 miles away. And he has to cross, Coast Highway, we call it Pacific Coast Highway in much of California. But it's at a major intersection, so it would be quite safe. And, very few kids do, and it's not popular, especially at age 15, where everybody's just looking ahead, counting the days until they get their license. So anyway, negotiating with him, you know, on different rides, like tonight, it's a 5-mile trip to Boy Scouts, a beautiful, safe back roads along the water. Not many kids his age are riding, but I'm trying to have an impact.
You know, Frank, it's interesting because as popular as cycling has become, you reference a change, a difference. I saw some statistics. I can't remember the numbers, but it was something like 30%, 40 or 50% of children walked or rode their bikes to school in the 70s. Yeah. And now it's down under 10%.
Yeah. I've heard it also referred to, but I can't recall exactly where, that September 11th scared so many parents. And then stories of kids getting injured on their bicycles or killed, you know, get such publicity and it scares parents to death.
Well, the parents should also look at the statistics that show that the number one killer of children is automobiles.
Right.
And being in automobiles. And another point, I think, which may be a wasted made here, is that people never make good decisions when they have an emotion like fear on board.
Well said, Bob. So while we're on the subject of kids, I feel like I got kind of a schnookered by my son. The first bike that he would, you know, agree to riding was a fixie. And I just didn't know what I was getting into because fixies, of course, are, it's not really a fixie unless you're continually customizing it. And the orange wheels and all the other accessories are great. But then a certain set of wheels require that he take the brakes off. That's pretty common, isn't it? A lot of fixies have no brakes.
Yeah, I think what we have here is a convergence of bike culture with rebellion.
No, it's exactly.
It's the Fonzie vehicle now. Instead of whatever he drove in Happy Days, he'd be riding a fixed gear with his leather coat on.
Right. What's it like in Portland? What are the rules? Bikes with no brakes.
Well, the law is pretty clear that you have to have a brake on there, an external brake. You can't use your leg force as a brake, which really drives some people mad. The really expert fixed gear riders have a legitimate point. The law is written to the average user, not to the expert. And so there's a lot of forms of, there's some decent amount of compliance. I've seen some people will put the handbrake in a very unique spot, so much so that they probably can't even reach it, but it complies mm-hmm. with the law. That's mm-hmm. their form of protest. We can't expect that a growing bike culture is going to be uniform. And we're going to have, these are people that might express themselves in a different way in the transportation system, in an equally unacceptable way. You know, I'm not my words, but, you know, societally speaking. But yeah, they're all over this town, in some parts more than others. I live in the Northeast, which is big old homes. And so I see mostly bikes with brakes on it. But if you go to the Southeast, where a lot of young people live in flats, maybe 6 or 7 to a house, that's where you'll see a lot of fixed gear bikes with painted rims. And then they put cards in the spokes.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I like bike culture. I like all forms of it. We have tall bikes here. You've probably seen those. To the fixed gear issue, it was litigated here. There's been some prominent cases, and an attorney that's also a bike attorney named Mark Ginsburg represented a few of these guys in court. And basically, as a result, it's been clearly stated that you need to have a brake on the bike, either a coaster brake or a handbrake.
I think for myself, observing my 15-year-old son, he's that age, he's reckless. You know, he's not going to listen to this show unless I play it in the car someday. But when I go out riding with him, I observe all kinds of, he doesn't have much fear. Kids don't at that age. And he's not perhaps like a young adult, really expert with his bike. Last night we were biking up to his tutor and it's all uphill. And at the bottom of the hill, he's asking me which front crank is the appropriate one to climb the hill with. So there's a kid who still needs brakes on his bike.
What do you mean by which front crank? I'm not following.
You know, there are small, medium, and large cranks on the front. And he had spent a lot of time in just one of them, I guess, and knew he was going uphill. So the answer is the small one.
I gotcha.
But speaking of kids, let's touch on the kids under six fiasco or bombshell that hit just a week ago, Bob. That made its way all the way down here.
Well, this was apparently what happened was a politician was, he's kind of a friend to the cycling community, Mitch Greenlick, and he's up in the West Hills, Portland, above the city, and he proposed a bill which would make it illegal for children under six to be carried on a bike or towed behind a bike in a trailer or, you know, ride behind bike or one of the other ways that a child can sit on a bike. Now, there's an existing law here in Oregon which was intended to make it illegal to ride two on a bike or three on a bike, what have you. So the bill would have been amended that law that existed to cover six and under.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he came across as a reasonable person. He wasn't, you know, some kind of off-base zealot, but he immediately ran into a lot of flack, and I remember seeing some of the beautiful pictures of women with children on their bicycles. And was there some incident in Portland that caused him to want to propose this?
He didn't list one, and in fact, kind of the shakeout of this was that there are no statistics. There's been no uptick in these kinds of injuries. There have been no high profile cases. It was really kind of a proactive idea, but as you've referenced, it met with a lot of resistance, in part because there are people that move to Portland to be car free, and then they have to use either the bus system or the tram system or tow their children around on bikes. And we do have a pretty good network of bike paths, bike lanes, multiple use paths, and share roads. And so it's reasonable to pull your child around that way. So I don't think we're going to see that law offered again. And there's a whole industry around creating these trailers.
Sure, you know, sure.
My daughter, I don't know about your son, but my daughter did some time back there herself in one of those little...
Yeah. No, not my son, no. But yeah, I see people, you know, young parents pulling their kids in those trailers. And yeah, that's a great thing. I think that's all part of, you know, showing the motoring public these heartwarming images of mother and child on a bicycle potentially change some attitudes about driving.
For sure. And if you really want them to steer clear, just put a puppy back there and then they for sure won't hit you.
That's right. So you know what? My wife, I come home yesterday and my wife, we have a dog and two cats, and the dog is a shepherd. So he loves, you know, shepherding the cats. And the cat, I have this blue-eyed cat who I call the golden cat, and he is such a lover. We take him for a walk every night when we take the dog out. So my wife is shopping for a basket that I can put on my bike such that I can take my cat for a ride. How about that, huh?
I think that's a great idea. My only advice, if you're interested, is to start them out young. I mean, if you're going to have a cat with you on a bike, I would start out as a kitten, but, you know, maybe your magic cat will be okay.
Oh, yeah, that's good advice. Well, Bob, there are so many things. We could meet and talk many times, and I hope we will. How about, you know, there are a couple of things in your book that push my buttons, like littering. I have often been one to eat an apple and toss the apple core out the window of my car, telling myself at the time it's biodegradable. But you opened my eyes on that. Let's talk about banana peels and apple cores, Bob.
Well, I've written on this subject quite a bit, so I'm not sure what aspect interests you, but in general...
I could get pinched for that.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. But, you know, it's interesting. When I first broached this subject, it was maybe 15 years ago, I got a ton of emails, and they kind of... they took on their own life, and eventually the discussion became about, you know, the insects go to the rotting piece of fruit or banana, and then little bigger animals eat them, and then eventually you get down to hawks swooping down to get the mice, so that you can actually set into motion an ecological disaster if you throw it on the roadway. If you can get it off into the bushes, that's certainly a better alternative. I mean, I cover these issues from a legal perspective. It's not really my own personal feelings. I don't see a huge problem with throwing a banana peel into a field or into the brush. One of the other lines of thought that came to me was that some of this is not indigenous to that particular, you know, bush or shrub. Yeah. It's not used to rotting banana peels. I see bananas right on the bike lane. Like, you know, the person got done eating and they just dropped it. And that, I don't understand that. Why would you do that? It's a hazard for a number of reasons.
Well, Bob, one thing I knew is I was reading the book that I made a note here that I was making notes anticipating questions I would ask, and I knew I didn't have to worry like I sometimes do with some guests that I'd get one-word answers. Well, you've got a great story for all these issues, and I haven't even covered a third of some of the scribbles that I've made in the book here. So I'm going to want to have you back on the show, Bob.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Tell us, Bob, before we say goodbye, you're an accomplished cyclist. You were racing. Tell us about your background as a cyclist.
I was a bicycle racer, the kind of guys you see probably quite a bit in Southern California with their multicolored jerseys advertising all the different companies, or, you know, even foreign companies. Nobody even knows what they stand for. I did that, but I did it when it was wool. You know, no one had Lycra on. I just got there right before clipless pedals. I got there before hard shell helmets and before Lycra, but just barely. So there's a bunch of pictures of me on Facebook with all this old gear. And then in the next session, I've got all the modern stuff, clip-in pedals, helmet, and all the bright colors. But yeah, I raced for about 10 years and it was a great time. It kind of took me by surprise. I didn't have the athletic, the aerobic pedigree to think that I could be a bicycle racer. And I think that's interesting because I think a lot of people probably make some assumptions about what it would take to be, you know, really good on a bike or proficient. And they may be wrong. It turns out that nearly any body type can do okay on a bike. You know, there's a multitude of gears and there's a multitude of different kinds of bikes and positions. And there's a way to get you out there riding no matter what shape you're in. And you will be happy you did it. You'll feel better about yourself. You'll enjoy your time on the road and you'll want to get back out there again. So for me, I started riding, and at first I was cycling with a guy in the ski team, and he was set about to just punish me.
Yeah.
And he did. And I followed him, and I thought, I'm never riding with this guy again, but I did. And that went on like that for a couple of months, but I didn't think much of it until I was in Milwaukee watching a bike race. And it was quite exciting, and there was a breakaway. You know, a small group was away from the peloton. And so I ran down to the finish with my friend, and I saw the sprint, and it was my training partner won the race.
Wow.
And a light bulb went off in my head. I had no idea that he was that good. And at that point, I was starting to be able to, you know, hold my own with him. So I went out, took out my license, and started out as a Category 4, which is the beginner. Now it's Category 5. You have a little bit further to go to get to the upper levels nowadays. And that's it, kind of. And I just took it where it took me. Just raced for about 10 or 12 years.
And then tell me about your aptitude. You decided later then a career in law was something that you wanted.
Yeah, I was a director after I retired from racing. I stayed in the sport, and I found out that I didn't have to ride or train in the rain and all that. And I thought it would be a good decision, but in fact, it was all the bad things about bike racing, which is travel and responsibility and itinerary. So that only lasted 1 year, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? I bought a coffee shop, and then I had a little mobile coffee truck, you know, 20 years ago. And then I just did some soul searching, and I thought, well, I need something where I have an individual input in my daily doings, and I like to be competitive still. And honestly, I used to play a lot of basketball, and the guys that seemed to have the most fun and had the most time to play were attorneys. So I thought maybe that, you know, for 3-year investment, maybe I'd get into that line of work. So that's what I did.
Well, you seem well suited for it. And again, the book is Bicycling and the Law. And however dry that might sound, I found it fascinating. It's well written. It's lively. You got a nice conversational style. And I'm enjoying it much more than I thought, Bob. So pardon me for those left-handed compliments, but I'm crazy about the book.
I'll take them anywhere I can get them, Frank.
All right. And thanks so much for joining me on the show today, Bob.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, we're back in the studio, and once again, let's say thank you to BikeTiresDirect.com. Thanks so much for sponsoring the show. Well, Bob, he's charming. I told you he was, and he has great stories, and I've barely scratched the surface, so I'm hoping I can get Bob back on the show. He's about to start a new radio show in Portland. That'll probably keep him busy, but I have a feeling I can get him back on the show in the weeks and months ahead. Well, I told you I was in Portland for the weekend. Prior to that, I spent 3 days in Seattle. I interviewed Peter Lagerway. I call him the architect of the Seattle Bicycle Plan. Seattle, of course, a gold city, as rated in bicycle friendliness by the League of American Bicycles. Peter Lagerway, a man who, well, he knows it all. I've got to say that. Spent a delightful afternoon with Peter. So that's the subject of next week's show. Spending this time in the Pacific Northwest, because there's no two ways about it, they're ahead of us. However you count it, they're 10 years ahead of us, maybe longer, in terms of advocacy, bicycle plans, city planning, influencing public opinion, getting community involvement. It just seems like the place to go to get answers to these questions that nag at me. Hopefully you're enjoying it. I'd love to hear from you. Come to the website, cdmcyclist.com. You can leave a comment about today's show. I know Bob would get a kick out of hearing your opinions. Well, until next time, thank you so much for listening, and good night.